Welcome to the Food Pod for Humanity, brought to you by the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Climate School, part of Columbia University in New York City. This is our sixth and final episode of Season 2, our series on plant-based diets and alternative proteins. I'm your host, Joshua Belicia. We have been on quite a journey this season. In Episode 1, we set the stage, speaking with Mario Herrero of Cornell University and Matthew Hayek of New York University about the current state of animal agriculture and its climate context. Episode 2 featured interviews with Francesco Branca, formerly of the World Health Organization, and Niti Jain, formerly of the New York City Mayor's Office of Food Policy. They helped us explore the connection between planetary and public health in our food systems, as well as the ways that the New York City government is nudging the city toward healthier diets. Neil Zacharias, founder of Plantega, and Gabe Huertas del Pino, founder of Archway Pets, joined episodes 3 and 4 to explain how their unique companies are bringing plant-based foods to our neighborhood delis and alternative proteins to our pet bowls. In our previous episode, episode 5, our communications and outreach intern, Ilana Schwartz, took us through the nuts and bolts of cell-cultivated proteins, or so-called lab-grown meat, along with guests Dr. Rosalind Abbott, Dr. David Kaplan, Melissa Musiker, Zoe Adamopoulos, and with contributions from Dr. Matthew McNulty. This episode, we have three incredible guests to bring you, an attorney working on environmental cases and causes, and two farmers involved directly in animal agriculture. They're going to help us wrap up this series by exploring the legal and practical problems and solutions for the future of food. First up, Peter Lenner, who is an attorney at Earth Justice and lecturer in law at Columbia Law School. Here's Peter to introduce himself and give a bit of background about what Earth Justice does.
I'm Peter Lenner. I'm the managing attorney of the Sustainable Food and Farming Program at Earth Justice. Earth Justice is the country's largest not-for-profit environmental law firm. So the not-for-profit part means that we are philanthropically supported and we provide legal services to a wide range of organizations for free. Some of those organizations are big groups like the Sierra Club or NRDC. Many of them are community groups that are often the community that may be right next to a big refinery or something that is particularly affected by the pollution. We've represented farm worker groups in many of our cases, say dealing with pesticides, because obviously farm workers are really on the front line often of pesticide impacts. We've also even represented small towns that are trying to protect their environment and are getting, you could say, outgunned sometimes by the big polluters. We represent a whole range of organizations, and as they said, all for free. I became interested in the agriculture system over the years that I've been working as an environmental lawyer, perhaps a little unusually. I actually started off working for the city of New York and trying to protect the New York City environment. One aspect of the New York City environment that many people may know about is our drinking water system, which comes from upstate New York. And for a long, long time, we really didn't worry about the quality of the water because the area was so underdeveloped and essentially empty that the water quality was very, very good. But over time, development occurred in the watershed, and the city had to start thinking about how do we keep that watershed clean? Because, of course, it's a lot more cost effective to keep it clean than letting it get dirty and spending billions of dollars to filter it. So when I was at the city, I started work at pollution sources in the watershed, in the area that drains into our drinking water supply. And I found that the tools, the environmental tools, such as environmental laws like the Clean Water Act and others, gave the city a great way to make sure that residential developments and municipal sewage treatment plants and industrial sources were pretty clean. And you could permit them and require them to comply with their permits. But I also found that those same laws did not give the city much of a tool to deal with agriculture's pollution. And so sometimes I found that I was suing a town because their sewage wasn't adequately treated. But right next to the town was a dairy farm with cows standing in the very same stream. And since one cow can produce as much waste as about 400 people, it doesn't take a very big dairy farm to create a lot of waste. And I found that agriculture posed a particular problem for environmental protection because the environmental laws that we rely on don't work that well with agricultural pollution. And later, when I was working for the state of New York, running the Attorney General's Environmental Protection Bureau, I similarly found that agricultural pollution was particularly challenging. There are a lot of places where, say, a dairy might contaminate drinking water, or a big dairy created odors that were really very unpleasant for the community, and other issues like that. And we struggled to deal with those. So, after working on general environmental law for 30 years or so, I thought to turn my attention to agriculture because it posed a particularly big problem and was really the unsolved problem. We've done a pretty good job cleaning up our air and our water, but we have not done that good a job cleaning up our food system over the last 30 years. We've also recognized over time that while often clients or organizations come to us with an environmental problem, sometimes we have to be a little more proactive. So we sort of start working on an issue and work with our allies and our partners to develop cases that will protect their interests. So we are largely litigation, but of course, sometimes litigation requires good law. So we also lobby to get good legislation in place at the federal and the state level. Earth justice as a whole focuses on a pretty wide range of environmental issues, a lot of efforts to address climate change by fighting dirty energy and advancing clean energy. We try to protect wildlife in different places, whether it be in the oceans or in endangered species or others. And we try to ensure that people can live in healthy communities. Food system addresses all of that. The agriculture is a big driver of climate change. It drives at least a third of climate change.
Earth Justice has a pretty long and storied reputation as a not-for-profit with a stated mission to preserve the wild, fight for healthy communities, and advance clean energy to promote a healthy climate. As Peter mentioned, they take on a variety of cases. With Peter's pivot into working on agriculture issues, he has gained some insights to share about the state of our food system.
The food system has a lot of different impacts. I sometimes summarize the impacts as cows, corn, carbon, and crap, because that's where most of the impacts come from. Cows are belching methane all the time, and methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. Cows also require a lot of land to graze, even though most of them end up in a feedlot where they're fed grain that is brought into them. They start their life grazing. So we have hundreds of millions of acres of the country that is devoted to cattle grazing. And this land used to be much more ecologically vibrant and supportive of wildlife and clean water and clean air. And it used to hold a lot more carbon than it does now, but it's been largely stripped of that carbon for either the grazing or the hundreds of millions of acres of cropland. And our cropland does not all produce food that we eat. In fact, most of it produces food that animals eat or that frankly our cars eat. We use close to an area about the size of all of the states of Indiana and Illinois together to produce fuel, ethanol, corn ethanol, and soy-based diesel. And that is an incredibly inefficient way to produce food. I've often seen, coming from doing energy work for a long time, that there's some real interesting parallels between our effort over the last years to create a clean energy system that where we rely on clean, renewable energy and use our energy efficiently, and the need to shift our food system to be inherently clean and using our land and other resources efficiently. How can we make sure that dirty food is internalizing its costs. And the main way you do that is you try to make it control its pollution. So we've been fighting for water pollution limits, say, from these animal factories and efforts to try to reduce water pollution from big industrial field operations. When those industrial meat facilities and their feed facilities have to reduce their pollution, then their price, the cost of that, is going to reflect their true costs. It doesn't really reflect the true cost now. Sort of related to that, trying to level the playing field of subsidies. There's often tremendous subsidy for dirty energy. And so one of the things that was done by environmental advocates over years was to try to create some subsidy for clean energy. Well, in the meat area, we see the same thing. There are tremendous subsidies for the animal feed and for animals themselves. We graze on hundreds of millions of acres of federal land, taxpayer-owned land, that they don't pay anything close to the market price for. Those who produce feed, the corn and the soy and other grains, get tens of billions of dollars of subsidies in order to have the cattle operations and the other meat operations be able to buy very cheap feed. Meanwhile, the plant-based food companies get very, very few subsidies. And indeed, it's also just the plants that people eat directly, fruits and vegetables, get far fewer subsidies than the big commodities like corn and soy, which are largely put into industrial operations and into animal feed. And then another area that has been very important is to making sure consumers know the truth. For a long time, you may remember that the fossil fuel companies denied that climate change was a problem. They ran millions of dollars of ads saying, climate change is a hoax and it's not real, don't worry about it. And if climate change isn't a problem, then a consumer might not be concerned about coal-fired energy. But now we understand climate change is a problem, and so that's been helpful to sort of push for clean energy. Well, the meat industry has done the same thing. They both denied climate change, but they very much denied that they contribute to climate change. They want to say, oh, you can have, your steak and it's no contribution to climate change. Don't worry, we're going to be climate neutral by, 2040 or 2050. So we've similarly had to fight companies that are lying, basically, that are misleading the consumer about the climate impact of beef. So all of those ways to try to advance a more climate-friendly diet have their parallels in the way we've shifted from a dirty, very heavily polluting energy system to a cleaner energy system. So we are pushing a number of lawsuits and advocacy efforts to make sure that industrial-scale agriculture is treated like another industry. We get the benefits of, say, a cheap car because we have big factories making cars, but those have strict pollution limits. And if we want certain benefits of large-scale industrial agriculture, they should have strict pollution limits, just like other sectors of the economy. We also are hoping to have that more honest dialogue, which is why we're bringing these consumer fraud greenwashing cases, so that consumers, as individuals, can make decisions. Because at a time particularly like now, when the federal government is failing us so dramatically, consumer action is going to be even more important. At a time when you may feel hopeless, what do I do? What can I do? Well, part of what you as a person can do is obviously vote when you have the chance to vote. That's sort of acting as a citizen. But every day you can act as a consumer. What you choose to buy, whether it be an efficient light bulb or plant-based foods or just plants to eat, will have a big difference.
In Peter's summation, cows, corn, carbon, and crap, along the food system, particularly in the United States, are part of the problem that leads to food being linked to roughly a third of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions, which, as you probably know, are the most significant driver of observed climate change since the mid-20th century, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. As he explained, Peter sees a lot of bad actors in his legal work with the agricultural sector and uncovers a lot of greenwashing cases where companies portray their product, policy, or activity as more environmentally friendly or less environmentally damaging than it really is. So, in all our hopefulness, we asked him if he sees any cases of plant and animal companies and agriculturalists doing things the right way for sustainability.
Like in any area, there's often people trying to do the right thing, and sometimes they're doing what you may think of as partly right, mostly right. They tend to be, though, frankly, relatively small. Right now, they get very little policy support for what they're doing. So the biggest operators tend not to be looking at it from this perspective. They may be very efficient from a certain perspective, but there's many other ways that they are not very sustainable. And so the good news is that we know that producing food effectively and efficiently and cleanly is indeed possible.
I suppose it shouldn't come as too much of a surprise that smaller producers are highlighted for their climate-friendly practices. Large corporations like dairy and meat conglomerates tend to be more focused on their bottom line and less agilely adept and economically incentivized to adopt more sustainable and climate-friendly growing practices. And many pinpoint the 1970s shift to large corporate farms as a negative development that increased meat production, but at the cost of smart and sustainable animal agricultural practices and also many small and medium-sized farms. In the U.S., just four meat companies, Cargill, Tyson, JBS, and National Beef Packing, now control about 80% of the pork, beef, and chicken markets in the United States. As we heard from Peter, the environmental impacts of growing and producing food are neither well regulated nor accurately reflected into the final production costs or the cost of the product itself, which means there are very few regulatory compliance requirements or financial incentives to produce foods that are less resource and impact intensive. But some farmers, many of them smallholder farmers, are still attempting to do so. We were able to talk to two farmers who work on animal farms. Robin Alders, honorary professor at the Australian National University, first female veterinarian scientist to be made an officer of the Order of Australia, consultant to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, and sheep farmer in New South Wales, Australia. We also spoke with Jenny Tilton Flood, who is a rural advocate and owner of Flood Brothers Farm, a family-owned dairy farm in Clinton, Maine. Let's hear from Robin first, and then Jenny, about themselves and their farms.
My name is Robin Alders. I'm trained as a veterinary scientist, but don't bring your pet to me. I haven't done clinical work for years. I'm particularly interested in prevention, and I work at the intersection of infectious diseases, mainly infectious diseases of animals and household food and nutrition security. From a very early age, I was born and raised on a farm in Australia, a beef and sheep farm. So over the years, I've sort of mixed field work with practical development work with some part-time academic work. Yeah, I've had a very interesting life attempting to manage a small farm, which is only 200 hectares. And I'm able to do that because my brother really is a farmer and he helps me a lot. But it's given me an insight into how challenging it is to farm currently, and then to be able to do that in collaboration with both academic work, supporting early career researchers and still being involved with projects and UN agencies and to the World Organization for Animal Health. It's a good mix. It allows me to pick where I think I can be helpful. And at the same time, on my small plot of land, to try and do something to make it healthier. What is considered small scale is very context specific. So here in Australia, with my 200 hectares, 500 acres, I'm considered small scale. However, when I talk to my colleagues from Africa or Southeast Asia, they assume I'm extremely rich because that seems like a lot of land. So according to the Food and Agricultural Organization, they often consider smallholders as households that have between 1 and 10 hectares. and this is usually in low-income settings. And they're characterized by the fact that they use mostly family labor, and often what they produce is also used for home consumption, small-scale, both livestock and plant producers. Their farms may be small, but one of their major contributions here in Australia and in each of the countries where I've worked is that they are the ones who maintain agrobiodiversity. So some of the indigenous breeds of livestock, the indigenous plants that are consumed, it's the smallholders that maintain them. They're a very important reservoir of genetic diversity, and they are not rewarded for that. So the spectrum of different chicken breeds, of cattle, different types of goats and sheep, the genetic diversity is held by these smallholder farmers. And they do it because in most cases, these animals are really well adapted to those local conditions. They're usually more hardy, they're more disease resistant, and they can survive where the higher producing animals that we've selected for over decades seem to produce a lot, but only if they get all of the inputs, such as the right feed, the water, the shelter. And if those inputs are not available, these animals don't produce well. So what we have on smallholder farms are breeds of animals and varieties of plants that we may well need going forward as we tackle climate change and as climatic conditions become more harsh. So I think they're going to be very important partners. The background to my farm is that I could afford to buy it because it had been poorly managed. It had an off-farm owner. They ran too many cattle, really, for what the land could cope with, and erosion was a significant problem on the property when I got it. The soil type is such that it's only suitable for grazing. It's not suitable for cropping. If you try to plow the soil, it just falls apart. So what I've been doing since I've taken control is certainly dealing with erosion, stopping water eroding further, fencing off areas to reduce stock movement, and also dividing up paddocks into smaller parcels of land so that I can move the livestock around, mainly the sheep, more frequently to give that pasture a chance to rest when it's not being grazed. So very expensive these days to get good quality fencing. And as I say, fencing off eroded areas, putting in tree lines, planting indigenous trees and shrubs, both for shelter for the stock, to slow wind speed, so as a windbreak, to try and hold moisture in the soil, and also as a source of shelter and nourishment for the local flora and fauna.
My name is Jenny Tilton Flood. I'm a dairy farmer in Clinton, Maine, which is known as Maine's dairy capital. I am a member and owner of currently four-generation family farm. We work really hard to make sure that we feed the people we call neighbors and people we don't even know. Our cows help produce around 18,000 gallons of milk every single day. It takes about 24 to 48 hours for it to find its way to those tables. And along the way, we do a really great job of stewarding the land and supporting our community and driving our economy. I'm a member and owner of Cabot Creamery Cooperative, 412 dairy farm families throughout New England and parts of New York, owning a co-op that produces some of the world's best cheddar and award-winning cultured dairy. I serve in many capacities as a cooperative member throughout our governance structure. I also serve as a representative of Maine's Dairy Farmers on the DMI board, Dairy Management Incorporated, which is our national checkoff for dairy. And there, I am fortunate enough to be vice chair of our sustainability committee. On our family dairy farm, we have around four generations, six families, 14 family members who work alongside a team of 46 full-time team members. We care for 5,000 dairy cows, half of which are milked every single day. They're producing 18,000 gallons of milk every single day. We steward thousands of acres of land. We produce generally around 60% of our cows' everyday diet. The rest we source from other farmers and upcycle from byproducts that may be produced in other consumer food production. We work really hard to feed the soil. We work really hard to protect the waterways. And we work really hard to make sure that our cows have the highest quality of care and that we do that in a sustainable way. Recently, we are part of a community digester through the partnership with Peaks Renewables. We contribute our manure, loan it to them. They capture the methane. They reduce the emissions here on the farm, not only with our cow's manure, but the manure from multiple other farms throughout the region. And that becomes renewable natural gas. So it's replacing about 45% of Peaks Renewables consumer requirements with a renewable natural energy source that's opposed to using an extractive fossil fuel. When it comes to the history of our farm family here on the banks of the Kennebec in Maine, the family lore is that we've been here for over 200 years and that the King of England deeded the land to the family almost 200 years ago. Of course, that land was not the king's. He didn't have a right to it. It was stolen land. We, like everyone in Maine, live on unceded land that was stolen from the Wabanaki. And we acknowledge that. We can't do much about it, but it's really important to own the impact, even if we can't own the intent of that. So that's one of the reasons that stewardship and sustainability is so crucially important to members of the family like myself. I married in. I was the John Deere parts girl, and my now husband had come in to get parts, and his parents and grandparents had been longtime customers of my dad. So it was kind of a meet cute, 30 years now at least, and with two children and a grandchild, we are a part of this long storied history of colonizers here in this land, doing the best we can to make sure we're part of our community and our food system.
I am so grateful to Robin and Jenny for joining us on this podcast episode. This season, we have been looking at not only strictly plant-based foods, but also other alternative proteins. So with them, we have the opportunity to explore some of our traditional proteins, like cows and sheep, and look at alternative ways to raise and manage them, hopefully with sustainability at the forefront. While this series has in many ways accurately highlighted the benefits of eating plant-based, vegan, and vegetarian, these farmers make the case too about the benefits of keeping animals as a vital component in our agri-food systems.
We need to find ways to be able to join up the people who are eating that food with its journey. And for instance, here in Australia, for some of the studies that have been done on soil health, what's been found is that the soil organic carbon levels are usually better on rangelands, land that has been managed with livestock, as compared to land that's been used for intensive crop production. For those cropping lands, soil organic carbon on average has dropped by 50% since colonization. Traditionally, and what has been done for hundreds of years, where you say grow a crop of wheat, you'd harvest your wheat, and then your animals, your ruminants would go in and graze that land, drop their manure, their urine, to improve the fertility of that soil before the next crop is planted. What's tended to happen in Australia in recent years is that the animals were taken out of the system and replaced by inorganic fertilizer. So it makes that inorganic fertilizer makes the plants grow quickly when there's water, but the nutrient profile of the plants is diminished and the overall health of the soil is also diminished. So many Australian farmers, cropping farmers, have moved to no-till production, but there's still a way to go to ensure that overall health and the profile of the crops is optimal. We need to think about how we sustain this growing human population. It's not just about the quantity of what we produce. If you look at, you know, the fertilizers that are used for crop production, they can also be contributing to problems. And as we know, with the selection pressures on white rice, selection pressure on hybrid maize, you end up with a product that's high in energy but has diluted nutrient profiles. So what is it you're producing? You're getting something through a system where it's the people in the middle, the people who buy from the farm and then who sell to the consumer. These are the people making the money, but it's not necessarily the best use of that product, and it's not necessarily rewarding the most nutritious product. What I'm trying to say is having a single focus and just saying animal agriculture is bad is not going to solve our problem. Some animal agriculture is part of the solution. Some animal agriculture is part of the problem. But to sustain humans and to do it in an efficient way, you have to understand human physiology and human nutrition. We evolved as an animal that eats both plants and animals. If we stop taking that animal source food, you have, as I've seen in many countries where there are high rates of child undernutrition, where children might only eat, say, maize porridge, their nutritional status is extremely poor, they don't develop well. Or you move to high-income countries now where it's very common for women of reproductive age to be having intravenous transfusions of iron. This is not natural. It's not a natural system. And often there will be a range of micronutrient deficiencies that you don't solve in an efficient way just by taking supplements.
When it comes to the demand of the US consumer and Canadian consumer for dairy, it's only increasing. However, it isn't that they are drinking more milk and want more milk. It is that they want more dairy. They want to deliver that deliciousness. They want to deliver that nutritional, protein-packed, bioavailable, most efficient means of fueling your body for those who are able to do so or allowed to do so through dairy, whether it's cheese or cultured products or products we haven't even imagined yet. That is on the increase. But with that demand for more deliciousness, more dairy, and better dairy, there's also a demand that it be balanced with goodness. People want good food and they want it to come from a good place and they want where it travels through to be good as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. As a dairy farmer, that makes me really happy because that's what we strive to do here on our farm. And the majority of farmers throughout the United States and the world, that's what they strive to do as well. As people want more, we're also finding out that we're delivering more too. As dairy, we are unlocking more and more the matrix that is within dairy, the issues it can solve, the ways it can be beneficial, helpful. We're learning more and more about the cognitive achievements and the importance to developmental milestones for infants and newborns, as well as younger children. That comes only from the makeup of dairy. We're also discovering how we can deliver some of the most high quality concentrated nutrition to those who have an experienced life years behind them, who need a better way to get that nutrition, a more succinct and efficient way of doing it. And dairy, when we can repackage it into different vehicles, we can make sure that we do that. And that's exciting. And we see that in food throughout the world, right? The more we know about what we have, the more we can dream about what we can provide people.
Joshua here again. Jenny and Robin both mentioned some health benefits that have been associated with a diet that includes dairy and meat consumption as a good source of calcium and iron, respectively. When integrated into cropping lands, animal manure reduces the need for synthetic fertilizers, and when well managed, animals can contribute to soil health and nutritional content of plant-based foods. The cultivation of livestock is also an important source of nutrition, income, and livelihoods for farmers in many parts of the world. As you hopefully know by now, the stance of this podcast is that food is deeply personal, and that we want you to consider the impact of your plate on your personal health and the health of our planet, there is no one definitive best diet for everyone to achieve that. Okay, so the idea is that we want to look into alternative, more sustainable ways to consume meat for those who are interested in doing so. So what do Robin and Jenny say sets their farms apart?
The term regenerative is being contested because it's used in many different ways. However, here in Australia, the term has been driven by people who love their land, usually family farmers who have seen from past generations that the old ways of doing things was not succeeding, neither in terms of the health of the landscape or the productivity of the animals. So really here in Australia, regenerative agriculture is being driven by producers who want to restore health to the land, to their production enterprises, while still sustaining a healthy family. And so what I've been doing is by reducing the size of the paddocks, what it means is at the moment, all of my sheep are in one mob, one flock, and I move them from paddock to paddock. So they go into these paddocks for a short period of time. They graze down all of the grasses and browse some of the shrubs, and then they move. Usually within 12 days, they're into a new paddock. And then it means that the grasses that are really important have a chance to regrow and to compete against the grasses that the stock don't like as much. It gives those grasses a chance. It gives a chance for the soil and the manure and the urine that the livestock have trampled into the soil for it to help the soil quality and its own health to improve. I'm sure as you've read about regenerative agriculture, you'll have heard of the work by Alan Savory, who's now in the US but grew up in Zimbabwe. And he observed that when large herds of antelope, for instance, move through areas, they move through, as I say, in very large numbers. They consume and trample a lot of grasses. They leave behind manure, urine, and then they go away for a long time. And in that period, when those animals have moved on, that land regenerates. So what we're trying to do on our farms is to mimic that. And we do it by using smaller paddock sizes and frequent movement of animals so that there's a chance for those areas to regenerate and recuperate while the animals are off enjoying themselves somewhere else. The Indigenous Australians here have been in Australia for over 60,000 years. They managed land in a very harsh environment, and it meant managing both plants and animals. It's a slightly different approach to what we're used to in these last sort of 70 years of industrial agriculture. But they managed it in a way because they were part of their landscape. They felt the landscape and they knew when it needed some help. And I know there's a big focus on ruminant agriculture and the problem of methane. And that's because you can measure what's coming out of a cow. You can put it in to a unit and you can measure. We're slow to recognize that methane comes off, say, rice paddies. The problem isn't the animals themselves. It's the way we've been managing them. Even the farmers are not necessarily the problem. They're subject to market forces. In Australia, to be a sheep producer, you're considered either you produce sheep for meat or you produce it for wool. In my case, the reason I raise wool sheep is because I believe that it's a more ethical and environmentally friendly package. Wool sheep, once a year, you take the wool, you shear the wool from them. It's a natural fiber. It's very durable. So well, when you buy well-made woolen clothes, it's not something you're going to throw away into landfill. It's a good product. While there's grass, they get to have their long life, both female and male sheep. At the end of their life, they can then be harvested for mutton, which is a really nutritious product. And if you manage that well, you can at the same time improve the health of the soil and build biodiversity on your farms. Very interesting work that's been done in the US, but what they've found is that land that is managed regeneratively, both the animal source food and the plant source food that comes off that land, usually has an improved nutrient density, also the concentration and profile of different nutrients is improved on products coming off land that's been managed using regenerative management practices compared to more industrial farming. And the difference there is that the weight or the volume of your yield may be a little lower, but it will be compensated for by improved nutrient profile. And one of our challenges is that pricing mechanism, our economic system in which agricultural products are traded. We trade agricultural commodities is still basically a 19th century approach where things are traded on the basis of weight or volume. Say for milk, there will be some analyses where it has to meet a minimum amount to be acceptable for sale. But to really reward farmers that are looking after their land, it would be ideal for prices to be weighted according to the nutrient value of what they're producing. And that would allow a more favorable return to those who are managing their land well.
I first have to acknowledge and articulate that our world of dairying and the way we've approached it, sustainability has always been at the forefront. And I know people don't think that, but the reality is that in order for this farm to work, we have to make sure there's a balance between that triple bottom line. We have to make sure that there is a stewardship of high quality of the environment. The environment is what we're based on. We have to make sure that our community is well cared for and our community is supported. We can't do what we want to do and what we get to do without that. And there has to be an economic upside, a profitability. Those three important pieces have to interlock. When it comes to sustainability, it's all about getting even better at sustainability. Agriculture is one of the few systems where it has been always about sustainability. It isn't that everybody has done it well. There are plenty of examples in the past and now, and I'm sure in the future, of people really disregarding the balance that is required of sustainability. And it's had devastating consequences. But on our farm, there are plenty of things that we have already done and we are doing more of every day. Like, how can we reuse water even more than we do? And that's what sustainability is here. It's really hard to find something completely new and different because what we do is very simple. Feed the soil, feed the cows, make it all work together. So a lot of the newer sustainability methods and attempts are all about increasing or improving those that we're already doing. We're already making sure that single-use water isn't a thing, that we are reusing water. We're already honing the genetics so that we are making sure that our herd is as healthy as it can be, has high longevity, is very productive, very feed efficient. Also, able to sustain itself in very trying conditions that are changing. You know, our climate is changing. And we've just recently been fortunate enough with the digester to find other ways to unlock the promise and potential of our cows and really look at all the cow can provide, whether it's heating a home or nourishing soil or nourishing people and driving an economy. Down the road, would there be wonderful opportunities to integrate more self-sufficiency and efficiencies with regards to energy production? Yes, that would be really great. If you went to the store and bought some of the world's best cheddar, which is Cabot cheddar, or our yogurt, that is not actually going to have milk from our farm because our farm is located so far away from the actual plants where it's created. We try to make sure that we maintain sustainability and quality of our products. So the farms that are closer to those plants, they're going to ship their milk there. However, because we're one of the member owners, our co-op has taken up the job and task of marketing our milk for us. So the milk from our farms goes to a nearby plant so that it can be produced and packaged and made sure that it's delivered to where it needs to be in a local system and supports our local food economy and food system. And being a member of a co-op means that we are the owners. We're the ones who drive the direction, uphold the principles, along with the talented staff and employees and craftspeople who take care of us as farmers, take care of the product and the milk that we produce, and make sure that the highest quality food gets put on the shelves. One member, one vote. Seven principles, all of them near and dear to my heart. And sustainability is at the top of that list for almost everything we do. Cabot Creamy Cooperative is the world's first dairy cooperative that became a B Corp. We set the standard and we continue to do so. And we're so proud of all the dairy co-ops that have joined us in being B Corps. For all my doom and gloom with regards to the challenges of being increasingly sustainable, when it comes to being a dairy farmer. I really think that the dairy community has met this challenge, and they've always been evolving. And quite honestly, some of the biggest proponents of finding better ways to do things don't even admit or acknowledge the climate crisis is a thing, because they are working to do things better. And that's okay. I'm not going to get hung up on it. I'm going to say, okay, that's great. That's fantastic. Guess what we can also use this for? We can mitigate this with that. We can mitigate that with this. So that's a good thing. I think the most important way to make sure that we continue to be increasing our sustainability on our dairy farms through raising livestock is finding more and better ways to do what we do and share that, instead of thinking about how does this affect the dairy community? How does this affect the dairy industry? The question has to be, how can this be applied to this industry or this sector? And we see that work already happening. We see that interconnective scientific research going on with regards to aquaculture and reducing enteric emissions, but also providing nutrition that is needed to even possibly fortify the milk that is being produced by cows. When we look at how can we find ways for manure to be even more important than it already is, whether it's potable water, water is becoming an increasing issue. What about feeding soil for agriculture that doesn't have manure, doesn't have livestock? And that's an important part. If you're talking about agriculture that doesn't have animals as a part of it, they need animals to be a part of it. Almond beverages, almond hulls are not something we want to add to landfills, which is a good thing that we have cows to make sure that they upcycle that byproduct. So instead of it being a waste, there's plenty of seed and grain oils. Dairy cows upcycle that chaff so that it doesn't simply emit gases somewhere else and add to the issue. We keep finding these ways that cows keep being part of it all. And dairy farmers are making really, really conscientious decisions on their farm, whether they're crossbreeding to beef to make sure that the whole cow is always going to be useful and honored when it's done with its career in dairy and done feeding people with dairy. It can now feed them with high protein beef that is local and more accessible, affordable, and available. We can make sure that we share our learnings throughout the world. 27,000 dairy farms throughout the United States that are averaging about 187 cows as being the average size farm. Global herd size averages around 1.2 animals, and many of them are stewarded by women. They are not necessarily efficient operations when you look at measurements with regards to emissions and with sustainability metrics that we're all comfortable with. They're doing it in a very different system. Being able to find ways to right size sustainability for folks without requiring they now have a larger herd. That's the important part. Part of the problem for sustainability when we have these conversations here in our part of the world is we forget that we are part of a world. And we're a very, very small part, but we have an outsized footprint. It's our lack of outreach and sharing and uplifting and empowerment that is the biggest problem we present ourselves with. And I think it's one of the most important solutions for global climate crisis and sustainability, as well as increasing nutrition and health and the idea that people can grow up to have options and be a dairy farmer or be a scientist or do whatever they want to do.
Though the definition varies, I think regenerative agriculture is most simply understood to mean methods and techniques that restore the health of the soil. Honestly, there's so much to regenerative agriculture, we could probably, and hopefully will, do a whole series of this podcast exploring the concept. So we asked each of our guests what best practices they see as the solution, or at least going in the right direction. Let's hear what they had to say.
So in answer to the question, what's a good food system look like? First is don't waste food. The second is don't waste land. We should use our agriculture system to produce things that we really need. We know that a lot of practices can produce food in a much more sustainable way. But those sustainable practices are often used on only, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% of American farmland, and perhaps even less around other parts of the world. So our challenge isn't always to invent things, but to accelerate adoption of some of what we already know. That said, it's also important to know that this is an area that has been starved for research, that agricultural research is one of the best bets that taxpayer can make. And yet, agricultural research spending by the federal government has been going down and down and down. And of that, very little of it is focused on how do we ensure sustainability or doing this in a climate-friendly way. We need to do a lot more research. And some of that is innovation, like some of the companies you've talked to on the podcast that are just doing it on their own. But they're not getting much government support for that right now. The whole plant-based meat area or the cultivated meat area gets virtually no government support. And that's very different from renewable energy that got a lot of government support over the years. And that government support was very important to renewable energy. So in an ideal world, we would have much more support for a wider variety of foods and be open to innovation. But in fact, the food system has often been pretty reluctant to take and invite in innovation. I think the first step is to recognize just how bad the system is right now, and it's unjust in a lot of ways. Farm workers face some of the most perilous conditions. Here it is, the middle of the summer. Working outdoors in the heat is extremely dangerous and obviously suffered by farm workers who are often undocumented and face many other threats. They are often on the front lines of pesticide use because they're the ones who get it both at work and maybe live near the farm, so they get it at home as well. The food system is rife with tough, very bad jobs in other areas. Slaughterhouses have some of the worst working conditions in the country. And further down the chain, the restaurant industry has often got tough working conditions. So, in an ideal world, if we think about just transition, we would really think about all the workers in the food system and how can we ensure that they are getting better, safer jobs. It's partly a question of what jobs may be reduced, but it's also looking at all the jobs throughout the food system and trying to make sure that they are jobs that are respectful of the people doing them. I think another thing that's different, perhaps, in the food system, you can envision a clean energy future where there's really just probably no more coal plants because solar is so much cheaper and so much better. I think one can imagine a much more varied food system where, not necessarily saying absolutely no meat, you can go to just far, far less meat of the sort that we have now, far less beef than we have now. And you'd have healthier diets, but people still can have food that is culturally important and socially important, just different proportions of it. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's who does one particular task, like say, ranchers lose their job. It's just a different proportion of people working in different jobs. And then I think what's really important is to recognize that there is a lot of money in the system. There are tens of billions of dollars of subsidies that go to the food system in the United States alone. Some of that is through commodity payments where they're just paying farmers based on what they did. Some of it are disaster payments. The Secretary of Agriculture just announced another many billions of dollars of disaster payments going out. And these are disaster payments that are often, frankly, for fairly foreseeable climate-related, weather-related disasters. So there's already a lot of money in the system, and that money can be used to help people transition to better jobs. And whether it be maybe deciding you want a solar farm on instead of growing heavily subsidized, highly polluting corn, you want to put some solar panels on your land. Very often you hear read of families that the farmers and the ranchers are in their 60s. And no one in their family wants to continue in the operation. And so help that family transition out, but maybe at the same time, help families that want to transition in, but do the activities in a somewhat different way. There has to be an active involvement in the transition, just in the same way that if you're, say, going to close a coal plant, you have to really think about the workers in the coal plant and how to help them transition to building the clean energy future. We already very heavily subsidize food, but we often subsidize the wrong food in the wrong places, and it's too concentrated among certain groups. So we can use that more effectively to help the human transition, the just transition, as we're transitioning the ecological transition to a more sustainable, climate-friendly system.
I have a small farm, so 200 hectares, and I have an off-farm income. I went into this drier period already running lower numbers of stock compared to my neighbors because I'm still trying to improve the farm. It's not running optimally. I've had lower numbers all the way through, and I've been moving livestock frequently. And I've been fortunate that my water supply, which is all via dams, that I haven't run out of water. So I've been fortunate, but partly that's because my income is not solely dependent on the farm. If I was a farmer where I had to support my family, then sometimes, you have to push things a little bit. You've got to have some income coming in order to be able to support your family. So I should say here in Australia, we don't have farming subsidies as you do in the US. We're very much working within the market. If there's a drought, we might get some support from government to transport fodder. If there's floods, we might get some help to put our fences back up. But we don't have that subsidy system that you have in the US. But from my experience with family farmers in Kansas, your subsidy system doesn't seem to work for small family farmers either. It seems to work for agribusiness. It doesn't seem to be there to support more family-oriented enterprises. One of the things that I've found working with farmers in many different countries is that really the problems they face are quite similar. The magnitude of the problem might change, but in most cases, the challenges that they face and the voices that they have don't seem to reach the center of power. So decisions are made to keep urban populations happy, and the policies that you need for a healthy and sustainable rural community just seem to be missing in so many cases. In the case of smallholder farmers in countries where land tenure is not guaranteed, this is a major issue. In some cases, it is simply about encouraging governments to make land available for family farmers, for smallholders to be able to purchase and hold their parcel of land. And in some cases, for instance, with pastoralists, they have evolved a very environmentally friendly way. The pastoralists that raise their cattle and they move with the seasons, usually along known migration routes, and they move their animals with the seasons to where there's grass and shrubs for those animals to be able to browse. And they take their animals to where the feed is available. Whereas those of us in high-income countries, just like us, we like to keep our animals in one place and then truck everything in that we need. Not on my farm, most of my animals are grass-fed. But the challenge we have with the expansion of sedentary agriculture across the world is that for these pastoralists, their traditional migratory routes are being blocked, and they're also having to change their lifestyle to become more sedentary. It's time for us as humans to rethink what does it mean to live sustainably, and how do we sustain ourselves while not degrade our environment. And certainly here in Australia, where Australians don't understand what's happening in our farming landscape, in our wider environment, and with cost of living pressures, they're just seeking cheap food in the supermarket. That basic message of eating whole foods, mostly plants, but look at that animal source food. And if you are going to slaughter an animal, make sure that you use as much of that carcass as you can. The concept of nose-to-tail eating, which our ancestors always did, it's really important. But what happens now, particularly in high-income countries, is that those animals go to an abattoir and somebody else makes a decision about what parts we're eating. We're not eating the whole animal, and often in many places, we don't have that option.
New England is, I like to say, we're very special. We're a special corner of the US. In Maine in particular, we're a little bit of an outlier from the rest of the country with regards to our statistics. While the majority of the U.S. dairy farms out there, and there's somewhere between 26 and 28,000 dairy farms throughout the United States, the majority of them would be considered smaller to medium farms, but the majority of the milk comes from larger farms. But there's still, of those 27,000 dairy farms in the United States, less than 500 of those are milking more than 5,000 cows. There's a lot of small and medium farms out there. In the state of Maine, however, we have less than 140 farms. All of them are family farms except for two learning institutions. They are what we would consider very small farms, except for about 25 of them who produce more than 2 million pounds of milk a year. So we have farms that milk around 8 to 16 cows. We have a farm that milks approximately 2,500 cows. And that would be our family farm. We're an outlier in Maine. We're somewhat of an outlier in New England. But you will find farms of that scale when you go outside of New England. There is a gain of efficiency when you get to a larger size, as long as it is done well. So while other regions of the United States may have a lot more larger farms or larger dairy farms, that doesn't necessarily mean that that is better and it is done better. And if an area has a lot more smaller farms, that also doesn't mean that it is better. It really comes down to not the size, but the farmer. It's like the business. It's not what the business is. It isn't the size of the business. It is how they run their business. That determines whether or not it is done well. Everything can look one way on paper, but it's really hard to say there is only one way to do something, except for I think we can all agree that doing something the best way is probably the right thing to do. And dairy farming is very much that. The issue of sustainability and climate crisis really needs to be answered and solved at the level of making sure that the people and animals and plants that exist on this earth are able to exist on this earth in a way that is dignified. Americans in general need to eat less beef. My friends in beef will hate me for saying that. Is the answer to import more jackfruit? I don't know. I myself love jackfruit, but I also am like, is that the best way? But do I need to make sure that my beef is coming from a good place? Yeah, I do. I need to eat less of it. I need to make sure it comes from a good place. But you know what I also need to do? I need to make sure that folks who are impacted directly by the eradication of forests in order to raise food for other countries that are raising beef to feed a growing want in other countries, I need to make sure that that situation is solved too. And I don't know that that comes from ending consumption of one product when I know full well that meat and dairy from animals is one of the surest ways to ensure that a woman in a different part of this world than I've been raised and I've lived in can make sure that her children are not only nourished and healthy, but can avail themselves of the opportunities of education and that they can invest in their community, and that they can also make sure that their community is enriched and empowered and nourished simply from the milk that their animals produce or the meat that their animals produce. I just think that it's so much bigger than changing your diet in the United States of America to a plant-based diet. It won't fix everything. When it comes to making systemic changes of our food system, both locally, nationally, and globally, I think the change does start with each one of us. And I know that I make it here on my farm. There's rarely a decision that we can make that is beneficial for us that isn't beneficial for our cows or our land. It's so embedded and intertwined. But as an individual, as a citizen, I have far more greater impact on those systems when I demand policies that are very impactful. One of the best investments ever for any farmer or any eater is scientific research that is well-funded and done, whether it's done here in the United States or globally, and the sharing of that research to make sure that those of us who are part of the food system and those of us that are recipients of the food system, that we have that knowledge and that it becomes de rigueur, right? That I think is the most impactful and most important. Research in how best to raise rice, how to perfect it, how to adapt it in parts of the U.S., an investigation on and research to help deal with diseases and the spread of disease in livestock and amongst plants and species is incredibly important as our world seems to get smaller and smaller with the movement of folks. I think that it is far better for us and far more impactful for us to do the research necessary to deal with these issues if they arise than to hope that people will stop moving. Of course, if we fed people, made sure they had shelter, stopped conflict, did not use people to be pawns in conflict, we would actually be able to halt some of the migration of people.
I think the common thread is the acknowledgement that food systems do indeed put a lot of strain on the environment. However, that strain is not solely linked to animal agriculture or even cows specifically. Inefficiencies can be found even in the raising of vegetables and fruit, and the food system tends to reward volume rather than quality of the output, thus prioritizing growing practices that may not be the most beneficial to our planetary or human health. My key takeaways from these conversations has been, one, listen to farmers, particularly ones that have a lot of experience and a long family history of farming. Two, subsidies rather than what's best for the land or even what consumers require or request, really significantly influence what is grown and in what quantities. Three, we definitely need more support towards research into our agricultural system about what practices are best for short and long-term success. That research needs to extend also to our personal lives. Looking into the source of the foods that we buy at the supermarket and at restaurants, to learn more about its impact where it's grown and raised, as well as in its transportation and storage. Four, diversity. We should all seek to diversify the types of food we eat. Try new things, like the vegan and vegetarian options that are increased under New York City's plant-powered carbon challenge, the plant-based bodega classics from Plantega, the insect proteins found in Archway pet and human foods. Try eating parts of the animal you may not normally gravitate to in that tip-to-tail eating style that Robin mentioned. It also means, to me, to diversify the food products that we invest our research and resources into, including cell-cultivated meat, plant-based proteins, and other innovations. Those are just a handful of lessons that I've learned through this season. This has been the sixth and final episode of the Food Pod for Humanity series on plant-based and alternative proteins, produced and edited by Joshua Luisa, Danny Din, and Alana Schwartz of the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Columbia Climate School. Thank you to our guests this episode, Peter Lehner, Robin Alders, and Jenny Tilton-Flood for sharing your insights and experiences. And thank you to all of our guests that have graciously lent their voices to Series 2 of this podcast. Our theme music is brought to you by Pablo Martin, producer and master engineer based in New York City. Special thanks to Jess Fonzo, Professor of Climate and Director of the Food for Humanity Initiative at Columbia University's Climate School. Not only did she conceptualize the podcast, but she has also been an invaluable resource and support for this passion project. If we are lucky enough to have another season of this podcast, the focus will likely be digging more into the topic of regenerative agriculture. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you have not already to get the latest information about our future plans and episodes. Though our season is now over, we can keep the conversation going. If you have any feedback for us or ideas for topics and guests, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at foodsystems@climate.columbia.edu.